Hey guys, in this episode, we're going to discuss how our childhood affects our adult romantic relationships and behavior. I also want to touch briefly on personality disorders and how it may be linked to our childhood. I'm really excited because I'm going to have this discussion with Dr. Alyssa Alves. She's a school and clinical psychologist from St. Vincent, but she's currently living and working in Grenada. Thank you very much for joining me.
Yes, thank you for having me. Very excited to be here.
Yes. So, guys, I want to introduce you to my special guest. This is Dr. Alyssa Alves. She's a school and clinical psychologist. She's from St. Vincent, but she's currently living and working in Grenada. So she's working as an assistant professor at the St. George University. And she also teaches classes in clinical community psychology and gives professional supervision to psychologists in training.
Right. Yeah, and actually today I'm actually calling from St. Vincent because I was lucky enough that we went remote quite quickly early in March. So I actually came back over to St. Vincent to be close to my parents. Okay. So I'm actually calling from St. Vincent today.
From St. Vincent. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I like that we're Caribbean. I just have to say that. all right. So as you know, this is all about how our childhood affects our adult relationships and behavior. So the first question I want to ask you before we go on to anything is, do you think that this is true at all?
Yes. Yes. Resoundingly, yes. There are really deep linkages between the experiences that we have in the formative years of our lives with our first models for our relationships, that being our parents and other people in our home, and what happens later on in our life. We see echoes of it all the way through our lives.
Yes. So I just wanted to let everyone know that, you know, this is real, this is true, even though sometimes, you know, we think that, you know, oh, my childhood, that's in the past. Like, what does that have to do with the present? No, it has a lot to do with the present. Uh-huh. So when I first thought about discussing this topic with people, I wanted to break it down into categories because it's a very dense topic. And I wanted to talk about how our childhood affects us as adults in different areas. So the first area is romantic relationships. And then I want to look at finances and our financial education, like our idea from, you know, where do we get these ideas from? Our peers and social class, family, beliefs, religion, and spirituality, and our relationship with self. So when we say, like, you know, this discussion is very dense, it is really very dense. But today I want to discuss with you how our childhood affects our adult romantic relationships. And I just want to talk a little bit about what an attachment is, because I don't think not a lot of people know what an attachment is. Mm-hmm. So before we go into attachment styles, can you maybe just tell me what an attachment is and how that is connected to my childhood and who I am as an adult?
Well, so, I mean, we can actually even go back even further than that, because I think that there is some discussion even in... outside of strictly psychological circles, so lay circles, about attachment style. Like there are books devoted to, you know, adult attachment style. But if we go back just a little bit further, I think this is helpful to think about too, there's the idea of temperament, right? So if we go all the way back to temperament, when you're born, there, you know how some people will talk about like, oh, such and such was such an easy baby?
Yeah.
And then there are other children who are more reactive, maybe a little tougher to soothe, maybe seemingly a little bit more sensitive. Yeah. So babies do come hardwired with something, right? You're not the person you're going to be yet, but you come already with some preferences, and that mediates the way that you are. Like there are some babies, like I said, who, you know, are very, very easy to soothe. Nothing really seems to faze them much. And then there are other babies who, you know, for example, startle easily, or babies who seem to have like a lower frustration tolerance. They get upset very quickly if they're going toward a goal and they get thwarted. So you've got that stuff. Mm-hmm. And then in conjunction with that, you have how your parents behave toward you.
Yes.
So let's consider something like, I'm a very easy baby and I have a really easygoing parent too. And, you know, we get along well, we mesh well, you know, in the brief instances where I do get upset, mom and dad are able to soothe me very easily and we don't have any major blow-ups. And that's one type of scenario. Mm-hmm. But let's imagine that I am a baby who's a little bit more difficult to soothe. And let's say I'm faced with a parent who, for whatever reason, and I don't want to try to get into parents' heads now, but, you know, for whatever reason, that parent has trouble managing that, you know, maybe doesn't have a lot of experience with a young infant, has their own stuff going on, you know, for whatever reason, the parenting style that you're met with when you have that temperament is one of, oh, you know what do you need now? Like maybe some sort of frustration or upset on the part of the parent as well. That influences the lesson you start to learn, even as a very little baby, a very little child, about how do my caretakers respond to my needs? Mm. And that's what ends up then informing attachment.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
So you're not born with an attachment style. Your attachment right. style is an outcropping of your temperament paired with the interaction, the early interaction with your caregivers.
Right. Okay.
So when you start thinking about like all those different attachment styles, you can kind of see where, okay, this would have been an outcome of those early lessons that you learned. Right. So attachment style has to do with it's an interpersonal style.
Right.
Really. It's your way of relating to other people, but more specifically your caretakers.
Right. So almost like your first experience with, I guess your first relationship or your first best friends or your first friend is your caretaker. So your first experience with your first friend or the people who taught you how to love or how to speak, that sets some kind of pillar that kind of goes on into your adulthood.
Yeah. I mean, I would even go further down and say that it's like people who teach you things, people who provide you with things, but also the people who establish your safety. I think that's a very big and important word to use because it comes up again in later life, this idea of like, what was communicated to you about the persons who are supposed to keep you safe?
Yeah.
You know, do you learn that the world is a safe place and that you have a secure spot from which to go and then explore further? Or did you learn very early that I'm not sure what the world's going to be like. I'm not sure what threats are out there. And then really like absorbing the message that, you know what, I can't count on things and people.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
Like safety. Yeah. Because babies are so vulnerable, right?
Yeah, like we have trust as well, right?
Yes. Because we can't do anything for ourselves.
And, yeah. Mm. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Very interesting. Mm-hmm. So now that I have a better understanding of what an attachment is and where it starts and where it comes from, I did some reading and it said that like you have a similar relationship that you have with your caregiver to your partner in life or your romantic partner. Like they said like similar things like you touch facial features, you engage in baby talk, like as adults, I guess you don't know what that means.
We do.
And then like you're really, really excited to tell a person when something good happens. You're very worried when you don't hear from the person. So the same behaviors that we show in our romantic relationships are the same type of behaviors that we showed when we were a child. So now that I understand what an attachment is, I think people might understand better what a romantic attachment is, if you understand what I'm saying.
Yes. It's a pattern. It's a pattern of interpersonal engagement.
Right.
So whenever we speak about a pattern in psychology, you consider like, well, whenever I hear the word pattern, I think of things that are learned.
Right.
And it's like, and then once you've learned something, how did it end up potentially getting reinforced through life? And then it ends up being almost like something that you do on autopilot. And you don't actually think about it. You just kind of fall into that pattern of interaction without even thinking about it.
It's interesting because I think we do it subconsciously, and it's not till we're aware of these things that we can say, oh, wow, that's why I do that. Or, oh, wow, that's why I keep dating the same person over and over and over again, you know? So can you maybe just tell us what types of romantic attachments they are?
Well, I can talk about infant attachments. I know that people, and you can extend them out to adult attachments. Right. So you've got the ideal, which is a secure attachment. And that's
secure.
Right. And that implies a few different things. It means that you're very tolerant of brief disruptions in that attachment. Like you're fairly certain of the strength of it. So it means that if that person goes away, or in an adult relationship, if there's somebody else who may spend time with your partner or is interested in your partner, you're like, you know what? No, we're good. I know where we stand. And then you've got some other types of attachments that are less ideal. So we've got ones that are fearful or anxious. Mm-hmm. So this is kind of like the opposite of secure. It's where, you know, we're doubtful. We're really not sure about what's happening when we perceive distance of any kind. You know, for some people that kid, like for a little child, think of something with separation anxiety. Like I don't like it when you leave the room because I'm not sure where you went. Yeah. But seeing how that might play out in a more metaphorical way or an emotional way in an adult, like I perceive some sort of emotional distance between you and I get very uncertain.
Yeah.
Or I see somebody else who it seems enjoys your attention or you enjoy their attention, and that makes me doubtful.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Then there are some other ones that are a little bit different. There's avoidant and dismissive.
Mm.
And those are people who run hot and cold. And a lot of these words are based on the research and work of somebody named Mary Ainsworth.
Yeah, Mary Ainsworth.
Who looked at infant attachment and looked at things like, you know, things like having a mother leave the room, and then when the baby gets, when like a baby who becomes very upset when mom leaves, and then when they get back, doesn't want mom.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that same behavior is played out as adults. Like, it's really weird, the same exact behavior.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So the mom gets back, and they'll continue to cry.
Yeah.
And might even push.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like you can almost like hear it. Like, well, how could you leave me here like this?
Mm-hmm.
And now you're back. What do you want from me? Mm-hmm. You know, so there you get that same energy being played out in adult relationships. Well, kind of the, I actually saw this just recently. I think it's a good way of seeing it. It's like there's a desire for affection, mm-hmm. but a deep fear of being vulnerable or being known.
Right. Okay. I can definitely relate to that. Yeah.
So wanting both things and really feeling like, and then, so there's a point at which you get close to somebody, and if they get too close, then feeling like, oh my God, this is too much. I can't do it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And pushing.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Yeah.
That does happen a lot. And I think that I can relate to that when it comes to, I would say, my family, not really relationships, but like if someone does something and it gets me upset, like I really want to embrace them sometimes, but sometimes I'm so angry that I'm just like, you know, no, like I desire to be happy and to be, you know, to be on a good page with you, but because of something else, I just push you away. You know,
mm-hmm.
yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah,
and I mean that can be a things that we learned when we were younger too, like maybe having experiences wherein you might have attempted to be open and vulnerable and found yourself rebuffed. Mm-hmm. So then you eventually learn the lesson of, you know, that's risky.
Yeah,
putting myself out there like that. maybe I need to hold myself back.
Yeah.
Because I'm not sure if I'm going to get a positive reception or a supportive reception.
Yeah, I'm not going to take
when that. When I put myself out there. And so in the end, if you learn that lesson enough times, you start being like, you know what? I'm good. I'll just bottle this up. I'm fine.
Yeah, exactly. And then there's also the dismissive type.
Right. It's like, I don't need anything. I don't need anyone.
But that's not true. Right?
Very few people need nothing and no one. But again, that might be due to poor reactions to things that have happened to you when you're younger. Like I said, in terms of like a parent being responsible for teaching you things about safety, they're also responsible for teaching you how to interact with your own emotions.
Mm.
So
you say that.
Uh-huh. Like, yeah. You know, like when a little kid is learning how to walk and they fall.
Yeah.
And they don't fall in such a way that they hurt themselves. Like maybe they just like, they tip over and they fall in their bum. Right.
Yeah.
You'll see like experienced parents will be like, no, don't say anything. Just let them get back up.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's you're signaling something to the child about the degree of alarm they should have.
Mm.
But similarly, if a child legitimately gets hurt or is legitimately upset, whether or not the parent kind of validates that, supports it, and kind of works the child through it versus being like, you know, stop that, suck it up, stop crying.
Yeah.
You know, you learn these subtle lessons over time about like, okay, if I'm upset, like what are the things I should get upset about? And if I am indeed upset, like, do I have a right to be upset? How upset am I allowed to get? You know, you learn some deep lessons about that. And maybe people who go on to be very dismissive have learned from their parents, like, you're not supposed to have a very wide range of emotional expression.
Mm. Mm.
You need to keep yourself in check.
Mm.
And maybe they learn from their parents that if they are indeed upset, that they weren't going to get much of a reaction. Mm. Or much
attention when they were upset. They didn't get those.
Right. Mm. Right. And so a reaction to that could be to just have less needs.
Mm.
It's because it's an adaptation, right? Like if I learn over time that, you know, when I'm hurt and upset, you're not going to act as though that's important or relevant, then I may learn them. I may get the message of, huh, well, maybe I'm making too much of out of this, you know, like there isn't anything going on here that I should be reacting to.
Right. And so then you don't react.
But in turn, that influences how you interact with other people, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So you're not learning the lessons about empathizing with somebody else's emotional state or what it takes to comfort someone or, you know, to join someone in an emotional response. So unsurprisingly, you go off into your adult life having real trouble with that.
Mm.
It's like just really not understanding, like, oh, that person is upset. You know, what does that mean for me? What do I need to do in order to be supportive? I don't know. I wasn't taught.
Mm. So then you just don't react, you don't deal with it. And then other people might think that you don't care. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
the thing. Or you might even, actually, I think this one is even more scary. The idea of, because I don't think that people, you can't completely squelch your emotional response.
Mm-hmm.
They have upheaval. They do have emotional upheaval. But if you're not engaged in conversation about it, if nobody helps you articulate those things, because emotions are abstract, right? Like somebody has to help you learn about them, label them. You may go off into your adulthood not having a lexicon for your feelings.
Mm.
So it's not that you don't feel things, but you don't know how to talk about them.
Right. I think that happens a lot in relationships. As I'm not saying men and women, but I'm saying especially men, I think, because a man is told to not be emotional by society and to be more masculine and to have this mask where, you know, he doesn't express himself. So I think that a lot of boys that went through that as a child now may have that problem, but 10 times worse than, you know, than other people do.
And yeah, because maybe the way we socialize girls and boys,
yeah,
plays into that, because we heavily socially reinforce girls to be more verbal, to pick up on the emotions of others, to prize collaboration and harmony, and to do that you have to be empathetic. Mm-hmm. Whereas we tend to promote boys being more individualistic, more competitive, and we do reduce their range of emotional expression in some cases, where, you know, if a boy is very upset about something, there are people who might be like, oh, that's far too sensitive, like you can't encourage him to be like that, you need him to tough it up.
Yeah, it's funny because it's like, you know, even with girls and boys, I think that we were taught what to feel and how to feel, and we weren't taught that it's okay to do certain things like feel anger. We were told to dismiss it. We weren't told to feel grief. We were told to dismiss it, you know. We weren't told to feel like only the good emotions. But I feel like if you don't feel the bad emotions, they're still there. It doesn't erase them. It just affects them in another way. Do you know what I mean?
I'm smiling so hard because I've worked very hard over time, and it's something that I like to do with clients as well, to take some of the value out of emotions.
Okay, to take some of the value out of emotions.
There aren't good and bad emotions.
There aren't good and bad emotions.
There's no such thing as a good feeling or a bad feeling.
They're just
a feeling is a feeling.
Okay, cool.
The reason I'm saying that is because, like you said, like I think you're very right in that there has been this dichotomization of there are things that are good to feel and okay to feel, and things that are bad to feel.
Yeah.
There are emotions that produce within us unpleasant sensations.
Okay.
The feeling in and of itself is not bad. I'm trying to remember where I heard this, because I don't like to quote things without being able to cite people. But I was listening to something recently, and the way they were conceptualizing emotions is that an emotion is a signal. Mm-hmm. It's trying to message something to you, right? And if we think of it that way, then again, like I said, emotions are not good or bad. They're just signals.
Right. They're just
signals. And they were focusing on anger and saying that, you know, like anger is a feeling that signals you to injustice.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I mean, it might not be real injustice, by the way, because feelings don't have to be rational. So sometimes feelings are based in fact, sometimes they are not.
Yeah.
They're real, they're valid, but they're not necessarily logical. Those are two different. It took me a while to understand that idea too. It's like, oh, it's valid, as in that person legitimately feels what they feel. It may or may not be logical, meaning it may or may not be based in fact.
Right.
But anger signals that I somewhere along the I have perceived an injustice.
Right.
Real or imagined.
Mm. So if I put that to, like, let's say a real life situation, let's say I feel anger and jealousy. If I'm aware that those emotions are not necessarily bad, they're just feelings, they're trying to tell me something, then maybe I can say, okay, why am I feeling angry and why am I feeling jealous, and stop and think about it before I react. So if I don't see it as a bad feeling, but I see it as my body trying to tell me something, then I can question it back.
Yeah, I think if you, when they're classified as bad, they become hot.
Yeah.
It's like, I can't explore that feeling. The only thing I want to do is get rid of it.
Exactly. And you can't really get rid of it, if you get what I mean. You can put it behind a curtain, but it's still going to be there.
Yes.
Yeah. Hmm. It's really interesting. I like how you said that they're not good or bad. They're just signals.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're just signals. I really do. I think that makes sense. I never thought about it that way. Yeah. Right. I want to just say, tell me if you think this analogy is good, or if it's simple enough. That everyone, even a child, can understand. So I think that, you know, when we're born, we're like a sponge. And depending on what you dip us in, we absorb. So even if my mother was great, she was the best mother in the world, she was loving, she's like water. right? So you dip me in that, I absorb some water, but then you dip me in some salt, you know, from my dad. And then I become a product of that, you know what I mean? And so it affects me long into my adulthood. But not only that, I'm dipped into different ideas. So I'm dipped into different ideas of how I should think about my finances. You know, I'm dipped into different ideas about my social class. I'm dipped into different ideas about my relationship with myself. So is it easy or is it simple enough to say that I am a sponge and whatever ideas I get dipped into, they kind of stay with me as I, you know, become an adult?
I like that idea. And I mean, when you use like that particular metaphor of a sponge, those different solvents, whatever it is that you're being dipped into, are you imagining them mixing and admixing and becoming more and more complex as you go?
Yeah, like a convulsion of stuff.
Right. There is that, and there is also this idea that like you can be placed in contexts that end up pulling on one part of your experience more than another. Mm. Right? So the self is multifaceted.
Yeah.
Right. And I assume there might be some people who believe that there is some sort of platonic self that is like the ultimate and central self. I don't know if I believe that there is such a thing. Mm-hmm. I think if you're placed in different situations, it ends up causing you to emphasize different aspects of yourself. And you draw on different parts of your experience to help you navigate the context that you're in.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
So as you get older and you experience different things, you have a wider range of experiences to draw on. But also the way that you think about your past changes as you get older too.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. Your perspective changes.
Right. So the lens that you view things through changes as you get older.
Mm. So what I want to say, because I understand that, and that makes it a little bit more clear, but let's say, you know, I'm this sponge and I've absorbed all these things, you know, growing up or whatever. But, yeah. And I would say that everyone has experienced trauma in some type of a way. People don't fully understand trauma, but I think everyone has experienced some type of trauma. So trauma is within this sponge. And now that I'm aware of it, how do I get it out? Or how do I like become a cleaner sponge? Like, do I need to like recognize it first? Because if I don't know that it's there, then I won't. Do you get what I mean?
So I like that question. And before I answer it, I want to go back to something you just said, because I wonder if some people feel like this, whether traumatic experiences are something that need to be exercised before they can have a good or happy or fulfilling life.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think so.
Okay.
I think that recognition is really important, like you were just saying, mm-hmm. because there's power in naming something,
mm-hmm.
right? It's, you know, we talk about that, like in more cognitive approaches to therapy, we talk about this idea of like kind of bringing something out of the shadows. You've got to bring it out so that you can actually, you've got to name it to tame it.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. So there is that aspect of it that you need to recognize it, label it, see it for what it is. But I don't think that what you do is extinguish it. I think what has to happen is that once you've recognized it, how do we let this have meaning within the larger story of our lives?
Okay.
It's, again, this analogy that I read somewhere and I really love, the idea of like, you know, the life as your life as a tree, you know, and you've got all of these wonderful experiences and happiness and that sort of thing. And that gives you span. That gives you, you know, your branches, your leaves, you know. But sadness, struggle, difficult things, those give you roots. Those give you depth.
Right.
You need both. You need both depth and breadth.
Right.
Okay. And they both have a place. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's this where, how do you make meaning out of that? And how do you use it to then, like, past traumatic experiences, how do you use them to enrich
your life?
Okay.
So it's not necessarily getting rid of, because you can't get rid of something that has happened, but it's how you use it to enrich your life and other people's lives.
Yeah.
That makes sense. And then maybe it can be like a generational something, so you can break those generational curses, right?
You can. You absolutely can.
Yeah. Yeah, I believe that. Okay, I really do like how you said that about the depth and the breach and talking about a tree, because I believe that it's almost like, you know, that seed that was first planted, you don't know how it's going to go, but depending on how you water it and the sun and all that, all these different factors, so you can determine how it grows. Yeah, and I like that. The last thing that I would like to ask you, is there a correlation between the parent-child relationship and the development of personality disorders? So sometimes I think people, so for example, I think people use the term narcissist very loosely. I do have a few friends that obviously have been hurt, and, you know, they refer to the ex as a narcissist. And I think that there's so many different types of definitions online. Like, I'm not really too sure myself what a narcissist is. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's important that we talk about what a narcissist is, but is it possible that the relationship between the child and the parent can then stem into, like, development and personality disorders, like bipolar or narcissism and stuff like that?
So, in terms of the roots of any sort of psychological disorder. So there's a premise that we talk about, well, a couple of premises, I should say, we talk about in psychology. There's the biopsychosocial model, this idea like there's an interaction between what you come hardwired with, so your biology, mm-hmm. what's going on with you mentally, emotionally, psychologically, mm-hmm. and then socially, meaning, you know, the experiences that you have. And so all of those things are coming together to produce any given feature that we see or something that might end up being manifested as a disorder. Mm-hmm. And specifically in terms of disorder, sometimes you might hear people talk about something called the stress diathesis model, which is basically the idea, it's the same idea. You come hardwired with some stuff, and then that interacts with stressors you might experience, and okay. that may or may not produce
okay
a diagnose something that is diagnosable, right? Mm-hmm. Biology isn't fate, right?
I like that. Biology is a fate.
No, fair it enough. Isn't fate. It's fair predisposition. Enough. It can produce a predisposition. It can create vulnerability, but mm-hmm. it's not fate because it interacts with your experiences. Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of whether or not, let's say, harsh parenting can then lead to negative outcomes in terms of either carrying a legitimate psychological diagnosis or even having a personality disorder later in life. Yeah, there's connections between those things. Mm-hmm. Let's look at something that's maybe a little less fraught. Let's look at something like whether or not your likelihood of experiencing a major depressive disorder. Mm-hmm. Your chances of that are higher if your mother was also depressed.
Right.
Yeah, like there's good linkages around mm-hmm. that, right? Mm-hmm. Where good research findings to support that idea. So there are connections. What the piece that I'm wary about, and I kind of sense the same caution with you, is, you know, putting diagnostic labels on people, yeah. Particularly as it pertains to personality disorders. Personality disorders are really pervasive. Like it suggests a deeply dysregulated interpersonal function mm-hmm. that spans through different parts of that person's life, and that actually impairs them. Mm. what might be more useful to talk about might be that within any of us, like that, you know, we can experience things as a or express things as on a spectrum.
Okay. Okay.
And to the extent that all of us can be self-centered, or all of us can be selfish, and maybe display something that is suggestive of the narcissistic traits. Is that possible? Sure. Yeah. Is it possible to do that in such a way that does not meet diagnostic criteria? Also very possible. Mm. And the question of like, well, how is this connected to your past? Sure, it definitely can be. Like who you are in the present day can be, have deep roots in what happened to you as a child.
Mm-hmm.
But all of that is to say, for persons who have been hurt by a partner as well, I urge people to examine the behaviors of the person who hurt you, sure. You know, like I don't want to let anybody off the hook for treating people poorly.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. I think as adults, to the extent that we can, because for some people it's very difficult, to the extent that we can, we have a responsibility for taking ownership for the things that we do and how we move through the world.
Yes.
And on the flip side of that, if you're having repetitive experiences interpersonally that aren't satisfying or are hurtful, then we do need to do some introspection as well. Not so that you can beat yourself up, or so that you can completely do a complete course correction that then ends up being like, oh, you know how like you hear people say things like, oh, well, I'm the only constant in all these situations, so the problem must be me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm not suggesting going all the way over to that end either, because I don't think that that's self-compassionate, nor is it helpful.
Mm-hmm.
But recognizing, you know, like when I have been in these situations, you know, what about those relationships was reinforcing for me?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what is it that I seem to do, like we were saying, like right up at the beginning, maybe there are things I do without even thinking.
Yeah.
Maybe there are patterns that I'm enacting and reenacting without being fully conscious of them. So mm-hmm. I need to turn the microscope back on myself.
Yeah, instead of projecting. Know. Yeah.
Right. And I say all that, like I said, not to shift blame, but to also keep things within the realm of things you can actually control.
Correct, yeah.
Because you can't make other people do stuff.
Yeah. That's very much a delusion. And I think that some people kind of do, we do forget, you know, especially when we love someone, we want them to do something or to remember that we can't control them. And I think maybe even as a child, like not being able to control our behavior when we don't get the way that we want, you know, like certain things like that, I think that it does have a relation to how we behave as adults.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I just like, I want to just issue a disclaimer just in case it's unclear. Like there are people out there who will be deliberately deceptive, right? Who do actually commit outright betrayals, people who are outright abusive, who mislead their partners and things like that. And there aren't excuses for that. And for that, no, you don't require introspection. That those things lie in that person's camp. It's like, you know, instances where people lie, betray, break the parameters or agreements of a relationship, you know, where they act. Something where somebody is acting explicitly in bad faith is mm-hmm. that's different.
Mm.
Yeah,
because I think it's really important to, even if you're in a relationship, have a conversation with your partner about childhood. Mm-hmm. And if you haven't already, I think that you don't really know that person, because until you have had that conversation, you can't fully understand, you know, who you're in a relationship with.
What I think is really interesting is this idea of like, so if you think about temperament and then furthermore attachment, how that connects to conflict style.
Conflict. Mm.
So to your suggestion that people have conversations about childhood with each other, talking about what happens in your family when people disagree? What do people do? Are you guys screamers and yellers? Are you passive aggressive? Are you negotiators?
Yeah.
And you just like you. I had actually the experience of being in a relationship with somebody, and we were having some problems. And we actually saw a therapist, and that was one of the questions that she asked us. At that point, I wasn't a practicing therapist at that point. I was in my early 20s, and it was such an illuminating question.
Mm.
Because in his family, they were much more, they were very vocal, but yellers. They were yellers. High emotionality. Yeah. And one of the ways that he would interpret like something being important or meaningful to someone was how loud they would get and how upset they seemed.
Right. Okay.
And he would criticize me continually for being what he called very dispassionate.
Mm.
Because my strategy is as I get more and more upset, I reel it back in. I get quieter and quieter.
Right.
And I choose my words more and more carefully.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I would interpret him as not listening to me, and he would interpret me as not being appropriately upset. And mm-hmm. we weren't. Yeah. We were endlessly talking. Totally different. Totally different conflict styles.
Mm. It's funny you say that. I can say, like, for me, I don't know, growing up, we were very, very emotional. You know, I'd say, like, yellers. I don't know. We sound like, I don't know. We always say we sound like Italians. Like,
loud,
you know what I mean? But then in 2 seconds, we're 5 minutes, we're back loving each other. So a lot of people don't understand that. And I did not know that that wasn't something that not everyone would understand until someone said to me, like, we just had a quarrel. Like, how is it okay now? So, but for me, it's like, you know, you just talk about it, you get it out. And then it's like, oh, okay, all right, cool. You know, but not everyone deals with that. So some people would think, that is crazy. Uh-huh. That's crazy behavior, but for me, it's not. So it's just how I think that we used to deal with things, you know. And this is like my aunts and my mom and my sister and I. We have these kind of conversations, but then we go back and we love each other in a second. So that's very. I think a lot of people will misunderstand that if they haven't had that type of experience, you know, and they might just. If you come at them with that and they're not accustomed to it, it might push a person into a corner or away from you. And then, you know, you just go at them more and more and more, but they shut down. So that is a problem that I had in a relationship. And I didn't understand that till afterwards, that, you know, that's not the way that he was taught to resolve conflict. So that's why we're not getting through to each other.
Yeah. And I mean, like, once you, again, like that whole business of like, once you recognize something, then what do you do?
Yeah.
I mean, particularly within romantic relationships, and a lot of what I think some people maybe want to hear more about is like, okay, so I'm coming with this stuff from my family of origin or my past circumstances. You know, how do I mesh my life with somebody new and create a new normal that has to do with my union with this person? And it is, there is a lot of that where it's like, it's a coming together of two distinct cultures almost, even if you're from the same place.
Yeah.
Because you came from two different households.
Yeah, two different family units. Yeah. It's so important that people talk about their childhood in a relationship. Because I feel like if you're in a relationship, that means that you're probably looking to take it to the next level. And if you're not, you're just playing around straight. So if you are in a relationship, talk about each other's childhood. You know what I mean? So that when you get to that stage where you have to resolve conflict or you're ready to have a child, then your idea and his idea or they come together seamlessly, you know, and the child isn't confused.
Mm-hmm. Or even if it's not seamless, that you can discuss these things in a way that isn't ultimately damaging to your relationship. Because I doubt very much my parents agreed on everything that had to do with parenting myself and my brother.
Yeah.
But at least in terms of the face that was presented to us, well, my parents are divorced, so pre-divorce. The face that was presented probably in my early childhood was very much a unified front. Whatever they disagreed about was primarily behind closed doors, and I heard more about it as an adult than right. I did as a child. I couldn't play my parents against each other. Mm-hmm. they were not having it.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. No, I'm really, really, really thankful that we had this discussion today, and I feel like I got a lot from it, and I really hope that other people, you know, get something from it as well, because that's the idea. Because I want people to say like, oh, now I understand where that fear comes from, and oh, that's why it behaves like that, and maybe we need to have a conversation, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I hope that this empowers people and it enlightens people, and it just helps us to be our best self, to get us where we need to be, you know, where we our potential. I'll leave it as that.
Yeah, I think one of the things I think about a lot, and the way I see my role when I'm someone's therapist, is helping them have flexibility.
Flexibility.
Because when you only know one thing, or you've only had one type of experience, mm-hmm. you only know how to do one thing, or you only know how to do things one way. It's like this idea, like if all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So
yeah,
it's a matter of expanding your toolkit,
right?
You know, you can develop new skills, you can develop new ways of seeing the world. That can allow you to, yes, it can allow you to expand beyond whatever you experienced as a child or earlier in your life. You can definitely work toward new understandings of yourself that can help you have better relationships, both romantic and friendships.
Because friendships are relationships as well.
Yes, they are.
Yep. I have one question from someone. You can just summarize it if you like. We don't need to go too deep, but the question says, why am I attracted to the bad boy type? I always end up with guys that feel that I feel need to be helped, that I feel I need to help or save.
Mm-hmm. So without presuming too much about this person, there are questions I would encourage them to ask themselves. I think that that's a familiar trope, the idea of the woman who enjoys a project.
Okay.
What does it mean? So you find yourself in situations where a person may present themselves as very needy, or you see yourself as being able to improve their life in some way, and perhaps extend and maybe even overextend yourself mm-hmm. in order to be of service to them. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's something that you get out of attempting to make yourself indispensable. Is there something, does that fulfill some need for you? Is that maybe some way of securing yourself in the relationship? Saying, you know what, if I make myself so important to him, if I contribute to his growth and to his life in significant ways, that means that he won't leave me, because he's going to, I feel driven to show my worth in some way. Mm-hmm. Those are the types of questions I would encourage you to ask. It's like when I'm giving of myself in that way, what am I getting out of it? And what am I getting back from those partners? Mm. Now, what is it that is, because people work on reinforcers. What is reinforcing me? Why do I stay? What are the internal conversations that I have with myself?
With myself. Mm. So in other words, you're the giver, but you gotta ask yourself, what am I receiving?
Yeah, what do I get back?
Is there a balance?
Yeah. You know, and what is the internal dialogue that I'm having with myself about my interaction with that person? It's like, if I do this for him, he will view me in X way. Mm-hmm. You know, is there some sort of particular, is there a particular type of regard that you're looking for? Is, are you looking for approval? What, like that, those are the things I would encourage them to tease out. And then there's also, just to our point about attachment, there are persons who are, who kind of fit into that bad boy archetype, who are, who present as unavailable.
Unavailable.
So the idea of there being two people, and an anxious, fearful person and a dismissive, avoidant person trapped in a push-pull. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Where I'm anxious, so I'm motivated to chase. Mm-hmm. They're dismissive, so they're motivated to push and run.
Mm-hmm. So then you have a push. Right.
So now we're in this loop, mm-hmm. with each other. That comes from some deep place of like, oh, I've got to run after. I've got to, like, I got to chase. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. So those are some things to consider. You know, am I doing this because I'm afraid they'll leave? And do I find that what keeps happening is something that is counterintuitive, where it seems as though the more I give, the less that person seems interested.
Right. Okay. Mm. Yeah. A lot of things to think about.
Yeah.
I really, really, really appreciate you coming on and doing this with me today. I know that people have got something from it. I have a feeling, and I just want to thank you. And you know, I look forward to having more conversations with you as well.
Yes, thank you. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Is there anything else that you want to say to everyone? Just like a word of encouragement.
Mm-hmm. I think the biggest thing that I'd like people to take out of these sorts of conversations is the idea of what next, because there's definitely a what next. Yeah. I think that some persons, unsurprisingly, when they start to look at themselves and introspect, they start to find out things that they don't like, mm-hmm. or things that make them feel really unhappy. And it's easy to get into like a really despondent, hopeless place about it, where you're like, so many things have happened to me. I've had so many poor experiences. You know, this must just be how my life has to be. And I'd really like to encourage people to know that there is life beyond that. Like you can learn new skills to make your life look different, mm-hmm. in the future. Like things, yeah. stuff that happened to you in the past they're not fate. It doesn't mean that your whole life has to be like that. You can change.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a psychologist. I'm a therapist. My whole business has changed.
I really thank you. Thank you so much. And yeah. I wish the best for you, and I wish the best for everyone listening to this discussion. And I want everyone to reach their potential. I do as well, but I have some work that I need to work on, and we will all get there together. Yeah. So thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right. Thank you guys for listening. I hope that you enjoyed that as much as I did, and I'll see you in my next episode.